Greetings and welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising Podcast. I'm your once again host, Jay Hursko. Joining me once again, I have my partner in crime from Toulouse, France, Claudia. Claudia, thank you for joining.
Hello.
And I'm not going to try and do your last name because I have to roll the R and I can't do it. So I'm going to sound silly. So I'm going to avoid that. And this week, joining us once again to talk about our new book, Project Life Cycles, we have author extraordinaire, Agile consultant, Johanna Rothman. Johanna, thank you for joining us once again.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm really delighted to be here.
It is always a pleasure. It's always a pleasure. So, Johanna, let's start off with the book. The book is titled Project Life Cycles. You had me in the first like 40 words where you had this line of, quote, I'm sure I swore or set or something equally as useful as a response. So you had me sold with that. But that's a terrible lead into the actual topic of the book. So how would you describe the topic of the book for someone who hasn't looked at it yet and has no idea what they're actually going to be listening to?
So I wrote this book because I see so much really bad Agile. And I see so many people saying, Agile doesn't work. Scrum this, save that. You name a framework or a method, and it does not work. It's totally bankrupt. I don't know why we have to do this. It's not the team's choice. And then, even worse, the managers say to people, what's your personal velocity? So, I mean, what has happened in the industry is a total bankrupting of all of the ideas behind agility.
I would agree. You had me sold, and full disclosure, Johanna sent me a copy early. She had me sold because you start talking about the different ways to deliver value, right? Because it's not a project or product. We need to change the words, right? Change the conversation. It's all about how you deliver value. And I mean, the conceptualization of there's an idea of doing delivery serially versus iteratively versus incrementally, and just wrapping your head around that. And I thought you approached it in a very mature way, and not that in the sense of you weren't saying this is good and this is bad. There's no statement of thou shalt do this, which is I think a lot of practitioners, honestly, a lot of authors fall into. You came at it with, look, here's from the way I see it. Here's your three options. Each one has its pros and cons. Each one has its trade-offs. Pick your poison. You're going to have a risk somewhere. Pick your poison. And Claudia, I do think you'd agree that I think a lot of the times the problem that we run into, especially with the big A Agile or even the little A Agile, is somebody somewhere has an idea about how to manage or mitigate risk. And that, due to risk aversion, that drives a decision strategy or some choice architecture where we end up doing some kind of unsmart things.
Actually, the whole language of it brought me back to other times, other companies, other environments. And it really made me wonder, who was this book written for? Because I have to be honest and say I read it because it was Johanna Rothman. Because otherwise, I wasn't sure, not from the beginning. We'll get to the end later, I'm sure. But the beginning, I thought, this book is not for me. I'm not the target audience. It was not written for me. And it makes me wonder, who is it for? So who did you have in mind when you were writing this, Johanna?
So I have three different clients who each last year asked me, how do I get my Agile? These are very smart senior leaders, right? They want agility. And they don't like Scrum for many, many reasons. And they don't, in fact, one of them is not allowed to use the word Agile in their company, right? So, but they want the ideas of agility. They want the faster learning feedback loops. They want to be able to release every so often, much more often than they are now. And they want to know that if they have a prototype, that something like that will be in the final product. So I wrote this book primarily for the relatively senior project manager, product leader, a leader in the organization, right? People who say, you know, let's get over this Agile business. This is where I might swear again, without meaning to.
Do it. We're waiting for it.
Okay, well, the agile shit. So yeah. I mean they don't want that, right? Mm-hmm. But what they do want is agility. And my secondary audience was all the scrum masters, agile coaches, agile project managers, because yes, there is a need for a project manager where you manage the environment of the project so the people can get the work done. And that's one of the reasons I really focused on the flow metrics in this book, because the flow metrics allow you to do this without the nonsense of relative estimation. So I wrote this book, and you'll notice it's a relatively short book because, let's face it, managers don't have a lot of time to read. They have less time than they would like. So that's one of the reasons I wrote this book, to be short, to be straightforward, to say, here are the kinds of things you can do and understand where you are on these various continuums. Because if you know, you can make reasonable choices. And that's all I want, reasonable choices. So we can create a much better environment for the team.
That's a lofty goal too, reasonable choices. I mean, I will answer your remark, Claudia, with Johanna sent me a copy and I read it. And the first three people I emailed was the director of our PMO, the director of our teams that does tools and process, and then my co-director in the ATO, the Agile Transformation Office. And I said, all three of you need to read this. I said, because it truly, and they said, well, why, Jay, you're always sending me damn books to read. You know, why should I read this one, right? And I said, look, it lays out serial, incremental, and iterative development. And it doesn't say anyone is good or bad. It says that you're basically picking the risks you are willing to stomach by the path you choose. And I'll tell you, the first person who read it was the director of the PMO. And she came back and she said, Jay, this was a really good book. Like, I really like this because it makes me, the first thing she said was, now I understand all this flow shit when you mention it. But she also said, now it makes me think about the choices that we are inadvertently making by choosing our delivery method. And to your point, Johanna, the fact that I think I got them to read it was because it wasn't 500 something pages. I mean, I don't want to publicly shame this one person, but there was a book I read, it was 380 pages and it read like a dissertation. There were parentheticals and there were, you know, one, two, three, all these references. And I wanted to rip my own eyes out. And I think that's a sweet spot, right? Getting under the wire where there's just enough that you're going to get usage out of it, but I don't have to dig in and spend a month reading it.
Yeah. And well, Jay and I even talked about the structure of the book. It's still very Johanna. It's still got the same structure where you read the table of contents and you know what you're in for. So you could, we read through the book, but you could almost just pick and choose, okay, which one's calling to me, which one's speaking to me right now, and just go there and take it away. Because a lot of it felt like agile for the non-initiated, like, don't say the word, just tell me what it is, and this is the way work is, this is what actually happens in companies, and this is how you can make it better, or this is how you can make it more agile without saying the word agile.
Which is exactly what I wanted, right? I am beaming over here because this is precisely the reaction I was hoping for. And I have listened to all of you on the Agile Uprising podcast for years now. So I was pretty sure that when I asked Jay for a praise quote, he would give me one. So yeah. And I am thrilled that that your senior leaders actually got a lot out of this already.
We had some good conversation, and to the point where I have a new boss, and I'm trying to get this person to read it. And there's some other senior leaders who I break bread with that I've said, hey, you know, the head of the delivery org, I'm like, hey, this might be something you might want to think about. And because we've had the conversation, you know, what did he say to me? The exact words are, every agile person I talk to tells me projects are bad. He said, are they really bad? I said, no, they're not bad. I mean, everything is good and bad for you. It's all moderation, how you approach it. And I said, hey, you want to read this because here's why. Again, we're not choosing sides. We're basically saying this is what you're signing up for. One of the things you did call out, Johanna, and you've written a lot of books. Maybe then this is the impetus for the next book. How do we get people away from the cost accounting way of viewing people that, oh, well, I'm paying for 40 hours. I need 40 hours worth of work. And I've had some luck with the idle worker, idle workers conversation. But how do we, what suggestions would you give us for people to start understanding? Because it ties to flow efficiency. It ties to you know, the resource efficiency, which people organize around. Just because you're paying them for 40 hours, maybe that extra hours they're not busy, they're actually creating havoc and are more destructive. How do we help get people away from that? You know, Steve Tendon says, if they got nothing else to do, go tell them to go fishing. And he's not wrong, because otherwise you're just working to the system. How do we get in front of this?
So I'm that's probably the next book, my continual planning book. However, if you read the Unemployed Agilist series, that I wrote on my blog several weeks ago, I think that we can link, and I'm starting to work through this. None of you can see me on the podcast, but I have my hands going to try and form this Play-Doh of ideas into something coherent. I think that we can much more easily link capitalization and overarching goals with the pirate metrics. And I believe that if we start to do that, that will allow us to change the conversation about resource efficiency versus flow efficiency. So for those of you who have not yet read the book, and all of you should, if you have not yet read the book, resource efficiency is when one expert takes the item on the top of the list and works on it and then hands off that item to the next person in sequence, right? So you might have a UI or UX person and a platform person. Which one of them starts, it almost doesn't matter, but the middleware person is going to be next, and then the other person is going to be next, and then the tester is going to be last unless somebody finds a problem, and then we have a feedback loop. So this entire book is about how can we reduce the duration of our feedback loops so we do get more agility. And that means, how do we work as a team? Now, if we're being rewarded for team-based work, that's all that's totally coherent and congruent with agility. But if we get rewarded for our individual work, that's not coherent and congruent. And that's why an agile culture, an agile transformation has to be a culture-based approach, right? You can train people in any agile method or framework you want. That's not the point. But the point is that managers don't change the culture, and especially what they reward, you will never get an agile culture.
You're right. I think that's a major stumbling block. I'm glad that that's going to be the next book. I'll write a pull quote for that too, Johanna. Just send it over when it's done. I mean, the way you laid it out where, which by the way, the feedback loop thing, and you and I have had this conversation, I think it was online, the idea of the Winston Royce paper, which everybody blames as the genesis for Waterfall, where the first like 20 words in that paper, he says, this is how I've done it. It doesn't work. You need feedback loops. And then everybody just misses that last section and they hard charge forward. And it's like, well, you get the results you pay for.
So, and I really think that was a pagination error, because if you look at the actual paper, right? He actually says at the front of the paper, I would love it if software development looked like this. And then he has the nice waterfall. But he says, and he doesn't have the but until the next page, right? So some editor said, oh no, you cannot leave a dangling orphan or whatever that was, right? There's orphans and widows and footers and netters. And I'm pretty sure that's why the Royce gets blamed for the waterfall model. I mean, it's a lovely idea. I would love it if even my Saturday projects went like that. I mean, if my Saturday projects don't go like that, how can we do anything that requires collaboration and understanding across multiple people? I just don't get it. So yeah, on the second page, he has some of the feedback loops. And then on the third and fourth and fifth pages, they're like this nest of feedback loops. So yeah.
Speaking of Saturday projects, I feel like I should introduce you to the world's toughest project manager, which is my wife. But so one of the things I did like that you called out in the book, you called this out fairly early, is when you start introducing that concept of serial, incremental, and iterative, you actually said something along the lines of visualize the life cycle, right? Because that's what will tell you, that will tell you where your problems are going to be. That will tell you where your risks are going to be, which is everyone who's listening, the price of the book alone is worth that quote, because that really is the truth of it, right? When you draw it out, this is why we know Kanban works. When you put it up in front of you, it becomes real and true. And your suggestion of, look, just visualize how you do your work, and real quickly, you're going to start seeing there's some incongruencies there, right? You're not optimized for the same thing. You're going to create your own problems just by looking at that. And I read that, and that was like, man, she's right. Like, just start drawing it out. Start drawing it out.
It was so hard for me to wrap my head around, well, project and life cycles, like put the two together. And my initial thought was, where is she going with this? Because I couldn't put two and two together. And so we talked about how I thought, okay, maybe it's not for me. I'm not the target audience. And when I started reading through the examples, I thought, okay, she's making us unlearn and taking us to a completely different context. And it did make me realize I have not been in a company with that sort of environment, with that sort of maybe hesitation towards more collaborative, more iterative, more incremental ways of working, and that don't think about a product that actually lives beyond, we start this date, we finish this date, and then we move on to the next. Haven't been in that place for a while. So it really did make me unlearn what I have now taken for granted and relearn what it took to actually get there.
Well, that's really great, because I find projects to be a very helpful container for the product value we want to release now or in the near term future. And then we might have a different kind of a project as we proceed through the product life cycle. So I think what you're seeing, Claudia, is that the word life cycle is another overloaded operator. We have project life cycles, which manage the risks for the work we want to do now, and those are in service of the overall product life cycle, where we initiate a product and we shepherd it through more and more business value. And eventually we either end of life it, or, you know, all of our users really hope that they end of life it. I'm thinking of some well-known products that each of us has on our computers right now. So yeah. If I never got another upgrade to any of the Microsoft Office applications, I would be a very happy woman. I mean, just stop already. So, but I need to keep upgrading, because they still send me updates. So I think that the whole idea, and this is all about the inner feedback loops inside the project, which feed the next level feedback loops for the product, which feed the outside feedback loops for the organization strategy.
Triple loop. It's true. It's the, to quote Mr. Merrill, Peter Merrill, that's triple loop learning. Like, he talks about that, the nested feedback inside of one another. It gets you what you need to know, and then how you action is up to you. One of the, I think this was a self-reference, or one of the things you had, I think it was in Manage It, one of your previous books, the idea of the project triangle, right? The project pyramid. And yep. For those, this is terrible audio, but the three sides of the pyramid are work environment, people and their capabilities, cost and release. And then inside the pyramid, the other vertex is feature set, low defects, and time to release. And you specifically talk about how you need people to rank those yep. six, and your leader needs to rank those. Because then you understand, and the term you use is one of those is driving the project. The yeah. other two is steal a Dave Snowdenism. That's your bounded context, right? That's what binds the project. And the rest are all malleable. I had never seen that before. And I definitely have a copy of Manage It on one of these bookcases somewhere. But it made me stop. And maybe because I haven't read it in a while, it made me rethink where I would love to do that exercise with a leader. Just have them out of these six things, rank which ones are most important to you. And then you can understand not only how to manage that leader, but how to successfully manage the initiative that you're working on.
Right. I think I hadn't seen that. I hadn't seen it put that way. I mean, we're used to the iron triangle, the project pyramid, whatever. But seeing it with those different variables and then reading on paper, I did go back and read it multiple times. Only one can drive it. And it's so true. It's so mm-hmm. true, because if your date is going to drive it, if the cost is going to drive it, and then what's going to be kind of left hanging, it made me think of all those projects where we need to make the date. We will throw more people at the problem if we need to. People will work overtime if they need to. It's going to happen late. It's going to happen no matter what, because that date is what is driving everything. So it really did bring me back to other contexts where, yes, it was only the date that mattered. It was only the cost that mattered. So we're going to take people off. And it really does, for me, it translated to, okay, the people in this situation are not the first thing that we're thinking about.
It adds a clarity of now you understand where that North Star is. Right now you understand, whether you agree or not, at least you know
exactly.
That we are high.
If you know it, then you can do something with it.
Johanna, the anecdote I'll give you, I had my house painted, the inside of my house painted, and Lee, the painter, came over one day, and we were having a conversation, and he was asking what I do, and I started talking about this sort of stuff, and he said, you know, we have that in what I do.
I would have loved to hear that conversation.
And he goes, we have this in what I do, and I said, well, what do you mean, Lee? He goes, well, when I have a customer who has a job, I tell them, I can do it fast, I can do it cheap, or it can look good, pick two. And the one that you don't pick is where you're going to sacrifice. And I never had somebody put it to me that way, but I stopped and I went, Lee, are you looking for a job as a coach? Because I might have something for you, right? I mean, it's a little sedentary, but it's very, very true, right? You can have it. To your point, Claudia, right? If time is of the essence, right? They want it fast. That's the driver. Well, then the bind is, well, okay, well, if I'm going to drive this, well, then here's where I got to tie it together. It lends transparency in a way where it's not someone telling me, give me your North Star, which that conversation never goes anywhere.
Well, I love the idea of a North Star. I have a personal North Star, but I don't know. I think none of my clients ever think in those terms, right? They just right. don't think that way. I mean, maybe they should. I don't know. But I think that we can, that this notion of translating the strategic to the tactical, that's the kind of thing that I've been doing for many, many years. And the project pyramid is just one of those artifacts, because I once made the wrong choice. I didn't have to make that choice again, right? I didn't have to fail that way again. So that's why I started to say, tell me what is really the most important to you. And when one of my clients actually said to me, well, we really need to maintain the cost down here because we're paying you so much. And I said, let me reframe that to you. You're paying me so much so you can get it for the cost you want to pay, because you will have no way of doing this. That you hired me because I will help the people who work here actually be effective. Now, what's really driving this project? I mean, right. Managers, this is another of that focus on resource efficiency thinking that really makes all kinds of crazy activities in the organization and decisions. Yeah,
keep it, keep, we're praying you, be busy.
I mean,
apropos reference, Ghostbusters. In the original Ghostbusters, at one point, Bill Murray turns to Janine and says, type something, will you? We're paying you for this stuff. Like, that is, that's proof that resource efficiency is embedded in our culture. Claudia, is your audio back? Claudia, is your audio back?
Yes, I'm Fantastic. Back. Can you hear me?
I think you had a question around agency, right? And I saw that in the notes. That was a good one.
Yes. I'm going off of the basis that if you're, so we're in a context where people don't have agility or have fake agility, and they've, you know, for their career or for a certain time frame, have been told what to do. How do you work with people who have never been, who have never worked a different way, who have never worked in a way other than being told what to do? What would be maybe a tip that you could give them towards more agility, towards better collaboration, towards more agency and ownership of your project, of your product, when you've never known anything different?
Oh, that's such a good question, because I'm so bad at I am not quite an anarchist, but I have never succeeded in organizations like that. And I think that the people who do succeed in those organizations tend to want to do a really good job. Like, let's get that out on the table. They want to do a good job. And every time up until now, if they have poked their head up, somebody tried to slice it off. Right? So they are not gophers or whatever those little animals are in the desert. They want their job. They want their salary. They want their health care, all that stuff. And I do not blame them at all for any of that, for wanting any of it. So if I was one of those people and I read this book, then I would say, I read this weird book, or this book by this weird woman. And I think we could do something like this if we are willing to collaborate, right? Not all of us necessarily all the time, but at least a couple developers and a tester, or three or four people out of a team of 9 or 10, right? Could we manage to look at our work in progress and see how large it is now, and choose one or two things that we as a team can finish? Preferably, I mean, she actually says in the next week. I cannot see how this would happen, but maybe she has a point. If we only work on these one or two things and we work together with our colleagues, maybe we have a shot of doing this. And I always frame change as an experiment. I am one of those people who is a change kind of a junkie, because, you know, I have this vertigo thing. So my life is constantly changing. But I find that people are a lot more reluctant to change when it's imposed on them. If we allow people, if we invite others to work with us, if we allow people to choose change, right, to pick something that might work for them. And I offered several ideas in the last chapter, right? One of the big ideas is just make the project shorter. If you have a 6-month project, make it a 3-month project. And then it almost sort of kind of doesn't matter very much how much, what kind of a life cycle you use. Sort of, kind of, there's caveats there, right? If you spend 10 of the 12 weeks designing and getting requirements, no, that's too long. But a lot of organizations understand how to do 3 and 4 month projects. So just do them, right? Have release one, and then 1.1, 1.2, 1.3, or phase 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, A, B, C, D, I don't care, whatever it is. That already helps reduce your WIP. And when you reduce the WIP, you tend to make the aging not so bad, and you tend to make to in to lower the cycle time and increase the throughput. All of the stuff that managers actually want. So this is why, if you're part of the team, inviting other people and saying, you know, could we do something? What might make sense for us? And then if you're a project manager or a PMO person or any of those more senior titles, you might say as a project manager, yeah, I know we're supposed to be doing the Agile thing and nobody wants a retrospective. We haven't done a demo in 6 months. Instead of doing by the book, whatever that is, why don't we take a few ideas from this book and try them and then do a demo and do a retrospective? Could we do a weekly demo? Could we do a weekly retrospective? What would that look like for us? What would have to be true for us to do something like that? And then maybe we would change all the questions in our stand-up, right? All that other stuff. So I think that there are any number of ways, if you're not a senior leader, right, to introduce experimentation into the project. And if you're a senior leader, you can say, projects, all you teams of people, read this book. I would love it if everybody bought this book. And then said, what, based on your risks for your project and your risks for your product, what would make sense for you? And organize, right? Organize that way. Go thou and do and deliver me something in as little time as possible. Do you have to deliver all of it in the first week? No, that's not possible. But you can deliver something. And the more often you deliver me something, the more I trust you to deliver me something again, right? This right. Delivery is so intertwined with trust. I said that in the program management book. I'm pretty sure I said it somewhere in the Modern Management Made Easy books. I mean, that's all. The more we expose our work to other people in the organization, the more likely they are to trust us to do the next batch of work.
Yes, the competence, right? You can't have one of the things I still rattles in my head, Cliff Berg's Agile 2 book, was he talks about how you can't run around harping about empowered teams until your teams demonstrate a level of competence that their leaders, their managers can say, okay, I get it. You're doing well. Let me loosen the reins. I've loosened the reins enough. Let me see what happens. Johanna, I'll be honest with you. The thing that kept rattling in my head as I read the book was, and I'm not trying to paint, I'm going to paint with a very, very broad brush right now, right? A lot of agilists wanted to throw the project baby out with the bathwater, right? Yeah. And I know you and I have shared this opinion, right? We come at it with, there is no right or wrong. They're just different. Pick the one that works. And your honest appraisal of, well, look, this isn't perfect, but neither is this. It's all about a matter of risk. Like your hints for suggestions of working successfully in a serial environment, right? It's create smaller projects and release, and then incrementally release them. Create a cross-functional team for the life of the project. Use probabilistic estimation, right? This is anything, anybody who knows the big A, the Agile, right, can turn to a project organization and say, look, it's not bad that you got a PMO and you have billions of dollars in funded projects. What if we think about them differently? And truth be told, the director of the PMO that I shared your book with, that was one of the things that she came back with. She said, you know, we really do need to think about, so we can do projects, make them smaller yeah. So we can drive chunks of value. Because then you get past the sunk cost fallacy, you get past the anchoring, you get past all that stuff. And it's, there was a question in there somewhere, but I think I kind of lost it, but maybe this is a marketing pitch for people who are listening. Like, look, not all project stuff is bad. And Johanna actually puts project and product somewhere. McKerson kind of just made a noise, puts them together in a way that they make sense, that you can understand these two things and coexist and actually be successful together. It's all how you look at it, right?
Well, and yes, and if you look at the signatories of the Agile Manifesto, none of them were in the management track.
Right. They were
all of them were technical people. Now, I had known Alistair and Brian Merrick and several other the guys, because they were all gentlemen who signed the manifesto, which might be a topic for a different podcast.
when we really want to start, we're gonna peel that onion, because there's a lot we can unpack there. Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, they all knew me and I knew them. I think that they had such terrible experiences with project managers who managed the Gantt chart, not the project environment, right? If you focus on the Gantt chart, you never talk to a person, or you only say, you promised me this task by date, whatever. I wrote several books about project management. There are no Gantt charts in any of my books because I don't find them useful at all. Mm-hmm. And I do find that managing the environment, where we can say, how can we as a team achieve this next deliverable? That makes sense to me. And that's how I always manage projects. But if your only experience with a project manager or a regular manager is micromanagement at the task level, you might not include them. Although the problem is, agility requires a cultural change. Mm-hmm. If you really want an agile approach, you need a cultural change. Who holds the culture? Managers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So Johanna and I are going to co-author my book. I'm going to add her as the co-author, and I'm just going to steal a whole bunch of stuff. But I mean, it
are you going to use her writing style?
What are you going to take? She's not wrong. I mean, like Gantt charts. I just did a class in project manager. I said, look, they're only as good as the 30 seconds after you click save. And even then they're questionable. And they Gantt charts from in projects. The analogy is story points in agile. More harm than good. Does not add transparency. All it adds is friction and crying and screaming and a lot of uncomfortability. So when in doubt, avoid both the Gantt and the story points. Just avoid them.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Story points are just bankrupt. Yeah. Story points requires a kind of fantasy thinking, right? Magical thinking. Then if I turn my acorns and nuts into points, I will somehow avoid the when will it be done question. And Dan Vacanti wrote this great book, when actionable agile metrics and when will it be done? And right. Yeah.
That's the pull quote right there. If I turn my acorns and nuts into time, no one will ask me when will this be done. That's the pull quote right there. Cause it's
Jay, I'm always so impressed that you just memorize these things.
I'm here scrambling
through my notes and my highlights, and Jay just like pulls this stuff out.
I'm gonna use that because I definitely think that's a good one. Claudia, I know we're quickly approaching time. I wanted to give you a chance. Final question for Johanna. Final thought, final discussion point.
You took my one that I wanted for the end.
Oh, sorry.
No, it's fine. It's fine, because we did get to it about the whole proactiveness talk. No, I did want to say thank you for the differentiation between team culture and project culture or product culture, because I feel like even for the people who have this as their day-to-day, there's so much focus on the team part, and it almost feels wishy-washy if you don't, or very fluffy if you don't have the actual product culture that's associated to that. So it did feel like, okay, I'm just going to lay it out for you. This is how you get work done. Like, this is how work is done today, and this is how you could be doing it better tomorrow. So I wanted to say thank you for making that distinction. And I don't know if there is anything else, Johanna, that you maybe didn't make this cut and we could find in a next version, or what do you hope people get out of here, or what would you have put in there if there were less filters?
So I really wanted to focus on the team, that how to create a successful team regardless of the environment you work in, right? And that was the point of this book. The point of the next book, after I write the speaking book is how do we take that and God, I really hate this word, scale it, for lack of a better term, which is why I'm calling it the continual planning book. I gave a session at Agile 2017 called Think Big, Plan Small. And the clients of mine who have taken my practical product leadership workshop love it. And I'm still working on the strategy part of it. I'm working stuff out in my head because I really need to figure out how do I link flow metrics to what organizations need to report for their data, right? We have to report in cost accounting. How do we make the linkages make that easier for managers? And I think that there's something with pirate metrics, right? I will be doing a lot of writing about this over the next year or so on my blog, and then I'll be able to turn it into a book.
I'm seeing such a mashup between Johanna Rothman, Colleen Johnson.
There's a very, that Venn diagram, there's a very healthy overlap there. There's a very
I love it
overlap there.
Yeah.
So that's fantastic. We talked about the book. We got to lead into the next book. Johanna writes more. I think she, as she respires, there's like 1,000 words just fall out of her. Like, it's really kind of impressive. So Johanna, I want to thank you once again for coming on the show. We're going to have a link to the book, all the locations in the show notes. Claudia, I want to thank you again for coming on. It's for those that are listening.
I just came to be the fangirl.
But I will
just
say,
so I can say J-Ro.
That are
on live camera.
Yeah, here we go. For those that are listening that are our European audience, don't think just because you're in a different time zone doesn't mean you can't come on and have a conversation. We recruit Claudia way past her bedtime. So Johanna, just as we check out, if people want to find more information about you, some of your other books, where do they go?
Everything is on jrothman.com, jrothman.com. And if you would also like to learn to write fast and well, I offer a quarterly writing workshop. And Jay, I would love it if you decided to take it.
I think I might have to sit in. We'll talk offline because I don't want to put my ideas out into the ether. But yes, we will definitely talk offline. So thank you again, Johanna. Thank you, Claudia. Thank you all of our listeners for tuning in once again. And until next week, see you.
Peace.